Well, well, good evening, everyone. We are continuing our work through the establishment of church history and all that has gone on in the world. Today we are diving into what I think is, we are diving into this idea of the Puritan Revolution in the English church, and this idea of how it is that this transition takes place between the Tudor line and then what continued on into the Stuart line and the Puritan Revolution that took place there in the 1600s. We're going to talk a lot about that. When I say Puritan Revolution, I truly mean it. There's a lot of issues that take place with regards to the Puritan ideals and some of the things that come up with regards to how they clarify some of their beliefs and how they carry out some of these things. Like everything that happens in the Anglican Church, it's important for us to realize that you really can't talk about English church history or Anglican history without discussing all the subsequent political sides of it all. And so as we go through this, obviously we're going to be dealing a lot with the political aspects of this, King James the First, King Charles the First, and the English Civil War that comes out, that then you also have to talk about Oliver Cromwell a bit here at the end today, and the close of the Civil War, the end of the Protectorate, and then the reestablishment of the monarchy. We're not going to spend much time with that because our goal really isn't English history here. Our real goal is the Puritan Revolution that takes place in the early 1600s and the mid-1600s that leads to the establishment of some of these Protestant confessions, mainly especially the Westminster Confession. That's going to be kind of our goal this evening. And so if you have any questions, if you have any comments, you're welcome to ask questions. You're welcome to leave comments on the video. And if you are listening by way of podcast, by the way, welcome to the, surprising many hundreds more people that listen by podcast every week now. You're welcome to follow along. And sorry we're picking you up so late in church history, but all of the episodes all the way back to the very beginning are available on the podcast, and you can catch up as we go through history. This would probably be a fine time to actually let you know this, too. When we do finish this round of church history, which, if you know me personally and have been in these studies, you know this is my third time teaching through this over the past 6 years. When we finish this round of church history, what has been my habit is to return back to the early church and start over. I've done that 3 times now, and I'm not going to do that this time. What I'm going to do when we come to the modern day is I'm going to stop with the, you know, progressive linear walk through church history, and I'm going to return back to sections of church history and stories or interesting characters, and we're going to do deep dives, sometimes just one lesson long, sometimes 2 lessons long or something like this. Like if we want to know more information about, you know, the role of missionary endeavors in the North lands and the effects that had on Viking theology, like we could spend an entire evening on that, something that never comes up with regards to a regular methodical walkthrough of church history. If there's anything specific that any of you who follow this are interested in, you are more than welcome to email me. You are more than welcome to leave a comment on any of these videos on YouTube, or if you know me personally, welcome to text me. If there's specific areas or instances that you would like to address that after we go through this linear walkthrough, those types of things I'm already starting to plot out. So definitely get that in to me at some point. So one of those fascinating areas. Oh, Ken says, sounds like a terrific plan. Yeah, I think so too, Ken. As we go through this, I think it's always frustrating to me how quick some of these centuries pass by. I wish that we could spend far more time with some of these things. You know, as deep as we get into the 1500s, we still are barely scratching the surface. I think it would be awesome to spend an entire night just dealing with John Calvin's years in Strasbourg, for instance, because so many things happen. He develops his entire four office system with regards to the church, and that affects not only his role in Geneva, that affects how Presbyterianism develops later on. And so I think it's something like that would spend an entire evening on. I think that'd be awesome. So we'll see how it goes. As for our intents tonight, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about tonight, but that just has to do with, this is about the time that I've decided that's what we're going to be doing after we finish this linear walkthrough. And so I am open to any topic, any person, any theological debate, anything that people have questions about or interest in. I can assure you I will share interest and would love to teach on it. So that's going to be the plan going forward after we come to the modern day. That having been said, let's come into tonight, the Puritan Revolution in England. That is our fascination for the day. And I gotta say, after we walked through a lot of the English Reformation and we dealt with the establishment of the Tudor line, the end of the Tudor line, and even the beginnings of the Stuart line with King James I and his establishment of the King James Version, his trying to work out these issues between the Puritans and the Church of England and settle out these things. Obviously, being an outsider from Scotland, he had some issues with that. But the issues in England continue to morph and develop and become much more frustrating. And it does get to a point where you have people coming to blows eventually. The English Civil War is in the middle of the 1600s, and Puritans are caught all up in it. So are the Scottish, so is the English monarch, Charles I. All of these things really draw in trying to express what is the Church of England going to look like? What is the Reformation going to look like in England? And if you think that seems strange that over 100 years after Henry VIII breaks from the Catholic Church, we're still trying to figure out what the Reformation in England is going to look like, you're exactly right to wonder that. It is strange that it took so long. Lutheranism, for all of its ins and outs, all of its unique bits, really does establish itself very solidly early on by comparison. Sure, in the 1600s we have Lutheran Pietism develop, but that's kind of a natural, you know, progression. In England, it's nothing like that. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the church's legacy is tied up in its monarch. Because the way Henry VIII set it up is that it's not just that the church is separate from the Catholic Church. It's that the church is now wedded to the aristocratic monarchy of England. And as the monarch goes, so does the country go, which is normal. But then as the monarch goes, so goes the church. And if the monarch is Catholic, like Mary, then the Protestants have trouble. And if the monarch is Protestant, like Elizabeth, then the Catholics have trouble. And then if the monarch is both strangely sort of not Catholic, not totally Protestant, and not even English, but Scottish, like James I, then everyone's kind of tentative. Nobody really knows what to do. You know, James's parents, his mother at least, was Mary, Queen of Scots, was as Catholic as they come. And so people are still trying to figure out what is going to become of the Anglican Assembly, what is going to become of the Church of England, because it keeps switching hands. And while there was a huge establishment during Elizabeth's reign of balance between the extreme disagreements inside the church, it really, she does a good job just kind of holding it in place, but not solving any of the problems. So when James comes in, he's got all these problems that he's got to inherit and say, hey, how do you fix this? How do you make this move forward as a unified assembly if you're going to do that at all? And it doesn't take long. Now, I mean, at least on the empire-wide level, it doesn't sound long, or it doesn't take long for the problems to fester and become problematic to such degree that there becomes civil war breaking out. And civil war in the country, in a country that is also the state and the church, civil wars inside the church as well. Can you comment? Almost sounds like a pope charting the course of the church. Yeah, it does. Because, and so each monarch is going to play to that amount one level or another. It's going to have one strength or it's going to have one weakness towards that area, but the reality is that the monarch is going to define for the Church of England in these early years what direction it goes. And one of the frustrations about that is, while we're not quite in that period of revolution yet, where we're overthrowing monarchs and chopping their heads off, you know, that doesn't come till the 1700s. We're still trying to figure out then what is the state as well. Because if the state is so tied to the church, and we're still trying to figure out what the church is, but we're also trying to figure out what the state is, right? How do we address the authority of kings? In England, they had a tradition very long of the divine right of kings. The divine right of kings, I think a lot of us don't really fully grasp the significance of what that is, because the reality is that the divine right of kings wasn't just about that they had the right from God to rule. It was that they answered to God and not directly the people. In answering to God, you would say, well, that sounds like a nice cop-out. Then you can just break all the laws. Well, yeah, temporally. But all of them understood that we answered to God as kings. And so we hold ourselves to certain standards that some could argue would be a higher standard than even the temporal law. And that eventually, when the worldview breaks down in the culture with regards to the divine right of kings, the monarchy was going to crumble with that to a certain extent. And the parliamentary role and the parliamentary system begins to take a much more center stage. Now, in the early parts of the 1600s, just to bring up Parliament, because unless you live under a Parliament system, you don't really understand how Parliament works. Even if you do live in a parliamentary system today, it's different than what it was then. Parliament was only able to convene when the king called for them. So you can obviously see political issues will be problematic. When Parliament wants to come together, but the king doesn't want them to come together, it doesn't matter what Parliament wants to do. They don't have any authority outside of that. So a lot of it has to do with also they controlled the finances of the government. So when the king needed finances, he would go and he would convene Parliament, ask them for finances, and then ideally they would come to an agreement, finances would be supplied, and then the king says, fine, go ahead and disband yourself. They would gavel themselves out and away it goes. That was how it was supposed to work. In effect and in reality, it becomes this political pawn that goes back and forth and actually becomes the backdrop of what really precipitates the Civil War itself. And before we even get to all of that, let's kind of set our time and then set in our minds regarding what issues the Puritans were having, and then we can start to see how their role in Parliament began to structure all this. Now, one may wonder why we're going through all of this. And so I'll just kind of word on that. The thought process of Puritans with regards to the relationship to the state has dramatically affected how evangelicals, especially in America, of which I would count myself as sort of part of that, think of themselves and their responsibility towards government or their interactions with government. This time period largely affects that, because if you're thinking about it in your timeline, you're mid-1600s. Mid-1600s, not only are you dealing with the establishment of what England, the Church of England is going to be, but you're also dealing with the fact that people are evacuating Europe's mainland and people are evacuating England to a certain degree and to a certain amount, and especially after the Civil War there, that they start dumping into the New World, late 1600s. And then before another 100 years is up, they've founded a brand new country over here that starts taking over the entire continent. And so how all of this is going to pan out is going to affect the movements towards the New World. You know, Spain and Portugal and all those are dealing with things in the Central Americas and also in the Southern America. But in Northern America, where English and French interests all kind of mix together, it's going to really define a lot of things about how the country I live in and most of the theological discussions and movements get born out of for the next several hundred years. And so for those of you who are wondering why I'm paying attention a lot to England, it's not just because I speak English. it really is actually the other way around. I speak English because of all of this. This became the backdrop of one of the most influential countries with regards to modern church theology, and that is the United States of America, with all of its good and with all of its bad, with all of its freedom, with all of its heresy. America became a place of novelty and a place of settling all of the rejects from Europe, all of the heretical groups, all of the people that were longing to establish something else or to learn from what mistakes there were. There was all sorts of people that came here. But it became this place that whatever we learned back in Europe, we're going to try to put into practice here. And so because it became out of the English colonies and because it became an inheritor of Puritan ideals and congregational leadership as far as for churches are concerned, the English Reformation is absolutely essential to understand the modern church. It's largely expressed. The evangelical movement of the 20th century was based largely on Lutheran pietism, something we're going to get into at a later lecture, and on Puritan theology. So if you've been in an evangelical church and you hold to the sufficiency of Scripture and you hold to the importance of gospel preaching and evangelism, things like this, that is all born out of Puritan theology. That's one of the main reasons we're here. So because of its influence over so many things. So I keep on trying to set it up. Let's just go into it, yeah? The issues of the Puritans at times, you know, I say Puritan and everyone kind of thinks the word puritanical and controlling and really, you know, just scruples and boring and buckles on their hats and shoes and all that kind of stuff. By the way, they didn't wear those. But a lot of the issues of the Puritans, I'm not even going to say it in their defense. In defense of those who stereotype them as being really uptight, a lot of the things that the Puritans care about become a real overblown focus on quibbling over opinions. And when I say over opinions, I mean on all sorts of things. Much of the Puritan movement began in the late 1500s by an insistence that the crown, the queen or king at the time, should not impose matters of conscience on the priests or on the people. I want to say that one more time. Much of the movement, the Puritan movement, began in the late 1500s by an insistence that the crown, the king or queen at the time, should not impose matters of conscience on the priests or the people. So, for instance, the vestments controversy, right? If you want to look into this a bit more, the vestments controversy is a great place to just see not only how long that controversy went on, but it's just over what the priest wears during worship. The Puritans were looking at this and saying it is far too Catholic. It's too dressy. It's too ornate. It's distracting. It's pulling away from focus on God. All of these types of things. It's potentially idolatrous. You can imagine any extreme in there, from we don't like it to it's too Catholic to it's idolatrous. Obviously, that whole survey of opinion would exist inside the Puritan movement in the vestments controversy. But the idea that the question wasn't necessarily about whether or not a priest should have the right to wear that or not. That's a different concept. The issue was, does the king or queen at the time, as the head of the Church of England, have a right to impose that kind of outfit on a priest who does not have the conscience that says he must wear that? You see the difference? And so it's this idea that we have our scruples and we don't have those scruples where we think that we should wear those outfits. But when the crown tells us we must wear those outfits, that's telling us something that's over and above the law of God. And so that kind of controversy crops up, not just about the vestments, but it really crops up about everything. The liturgy in the church, the way to carry out certain movements, whether we have crucifixes up in church, all sorts of things. Some people were seeing potential idols under every rock and stone, but in reality, the Church of England was trying to understand how to do this. And so Puritans, don't think of them as outside the Church of England. They're not. They're inside the Church of England. This is an in-house challenge, if you will. Those who wanted to leave were called the Separatists. That's a whole other group. In reality, though, to say it from the monarch's side, if you are Elizabeth or you are James the First, when you're attempting to maintain unity and order across the whole land, regulation of clothing during worship really is a way to do that very well. If you think about it, you don't have to go back very far into the past when every single pastor, if you walked into a church, every single pastor would be wearing a full-on suit with a tie and a collared shirt. Now, I wear a little bit less than that. You know, it's like usually a corduroy jacket, no tie, a button-up shirt, and either jeans or slacks or something like this, right? And, you know, who can say one way or the other? But in reality, that kind of uniform concept brought an expectation to it from there. Now, in the 20th century, if you go to any church in America or anything like that, the vast majority of them would be looking like this. Not so much anymore. And that's an interesting movement in the modern church. But the imposition of that from the top was really one of the issues that the Puritans were having a massive issue with during Elizabeth's reign and during especially the later reigns of James, and then it all blew up under Charles the First. And so after the Tudor line comes to a close with Elizabeth, remember, the Tudor line was not very long. You had Henry the Seventh, you had Henry the Eighth, and then Edward the Eighth's three kids, Edward, Mary, and then Elizabeth. And Elizabeth, we don't really know why, she never got married, and she died without children, no heirs, no real claim to the Tudor line throne because there weren't any other descendants. All the claims were really distant. In fact, one of the closest claims was currently king in Scotland, and that is James the First. James the First is our first monarch we're going to be paying massive attention to tonight. And the reason for that is because his dealings with the Puritans was probably one of the best ways to attempt a solution. There's those who theorize that if James the First continued to live on for a couple more decades, that there actually never would have been an English Civil War, which is an interesting hypothetical, you know, possible outcome of all of this stuff. But he really had a knack for leading and for bringing two sides together to give them a similar outcome. But as it was, he was only king for 21 years. And those 21 years, he did a lot to address some of these issues, but the complaints and then the issues between him and the Puritans began to double over. And you know how it gets when you have one argument and then it doesn't get resolved. And then another thing comes up. Well, that doesn't get resolved. And then you start having proxy wars. And then you start having disagreements over things that neither of you really care about. And it kind of just slowly grew apart between James and the Puritans. But if you remember correctly, James at first attempted to bring together the Puritans and those who were inside the Church of England that were not happy with one another and tried to resolve them together. It was one of his first things he did, and that was the Hampton Court Conference. We talked about that a few weeks ago with regards to, you know, addressing the concerns both of the Puritans and the rest of the Anglican Church. By the way, I use the term Anglican because we use that in retroflex. They didn't call themselves that. They were just the Church of England. But you know, it's a mouthful, so Anglican Church works for me. Puritans were, you know, being way too nitpicky, and the Anglicans elsewise that weren't Puritans were being, you know, they were ignoring their brethren too much, and James was trying to hold both of them at fault and then bring them together on a unified intention, and that was one of the things that everyone was agreeing with, was that we didn't have a current translation of the Bible. That's where the King James Bible comes from. And regardless of what you think about that, a remarkable work and a very expensive thing and very well done at the time. There's just simply no way they could have done anything better. Remarkable thing. and also most influential English translation in history. And, you know, it's important, and I brought this up back then, it was important that as you open, if you ever look, open up a facsimile of the 1611 King James Version, you will not see any notes, you will not see any, you know, theory or theology or connections or this talks about that or introductions to the, or maps, nothing. Just the text. Why? Because James knew that this was the one thing that both of them could agree on. Scripture. And so pretty stroke of genius there with regards to how to pull them out of themselves, because honestly, it was true. As he was saying, the Puritans were nitpicky about a lot of stuff. And this is a really interesting thing, because it kind of illustrates for us the importance of holding what's essential and what's non-essential in two different boxes. Because what really ends up happening here is that everything for the Puritans gets tossed over to the essentials box. And that's usually a sign of an extreme position. When everything is important, nothing is really important. If you defend the deity of Christ at the same veracity, with the same ferocious level as you will when you speak against the use of the cross inside the worship service, or the sign of the cross across your chest, or in dealing with issues of dress or of luxury or of ostentation of the court or something like this, or even the way some of the churches were celebrating communion, whether it was on an altar, whether it was on the table, or whether it was in central, or it was off to the side. People had all sorts of opinions about what this meant about you, how close to Catholicism you were, how close to Arminianism you were, or how close to Christ you were. And yeah, those comparisons were all drawn. You know, it even came down to how one prays. You know, prayer in a lot of the Puritan mindset was to be impromptu and verbalized rather than written. You know, so that doesn't really interact with Anglicanism very well, which is their liturgy is literally founded on the Book of Common Prayer. And so that doesn't really settle well with some of the Anglicans with regards to it. I'm not speaking of Anglicans against Puritans. Puritans are Anglicans. It's just for those who would be defining themselves more by the Church of England, saying that you can't really have sincere written prayers is kind of offensive. That also caused issue with the historic usage of the Lord's Prayer, for instance, and how that works out. In their fervor to try to establish a biblical concept of how the church ought to look, they ended up having a full-on opposition to bishops, some of them. The idea that there was not the opposition to pastors, but then that there was another level above them called bishops that would oversee each diocese. And they would argue that this office of bishop is not from the Bible. I'll just toss my little church theology part in here as well and say that is true. The office of bishop was not from the Bible. It was from the early church, but it was not from the Bible. And they argued that a truly biblical church ought to be ruled by elders, not just overseen by a bishop, and not just a singular pastor. That's also true. And some were having opinions. Some Puritans would have the opinion that, you know, the scriptures actually put forward many different types of church governance. That's a little bit hard to argue, but some did. And because this is the reality, is that the Puritan position was not a unified position. And so that made it very difficult for someone like James I to walk into and go, how do I solve all of this? How do I address this issue or that issue when in reality I've got those who are claiming to be Puritans that argue against the Episcopalian form of church governance, and then those who are pushing for the Presbyterian form of church governance, and then those who are wanting to be independent entirely, right? Because out of all of this, you have the frustration of the most annoying group ever, my guys, the Baptists, to rise out of all of this. The First Baptist Church in England is in 1611, by the way, so just kind of get the whole thing that's going on with this. They take issue with the idea of infant baptism, yet another thing that they would argue is not in Scripture. And again, you can see this kind of desire to go back to scripture. Go back to where we came from. That's still very much in the air here. And even in the Baptists, then you got to separate. This is something that Baptists become better at than anyone else is separating from each other when we disagree over anything. You got the Baptists of the salted matzah bread and the Baptists of the unsalted matzah bread for communion, right? And so the first separation in the Baptists were the general and the particular Baptists here at the same time, kind of born out of this whole Puritan ideal and looking to fix the issues in the Anglican assembly. Obviously, the Baptists would not consider them part of the Anglican assembly at all, at least eventually. They'd consider themselves independent. And so the general Baptists would hold that salvation was generally available to all people, and the particular Baptists, if you've ever heard that terminology, was that only the predestined will be saved. We'll talk about the Baptists later when we talk about all the offshoot groups, Quakers and all that kind of stuff. And okay, back to James I. The Puritans did not trust James. As I mentioned before, his mother was Mary, Queen of Scots, a devout Catholic who did not make Protestants' lives easy up in Scotland. James, as I also mentioned before, held to the absolute authority of the monarch, the divine right of kings. The king was above the law, not in the manner that he was free to break the law, but that he's not answering to his subjects for infractions against the law. He answers to God when he dies. Now, it would be wrong of any of us from this time period to impose back on that kind of modern politics and say, well, I'm sure they just took advantage of everything. Some kings did, but most kings would hold a real fear of God with regards to this. Even if not a personal thing, it would be a cultural pressure. It is incredibly difficult to look back on history and go, oh, they didn't actually, you know, revere God. They did. And when they saw this responsibility and the anticipation that when I die, I will face my maker, that, if for no other reasons, as a cultural pressure, was enough to hold back a lot of the evil that is in monarchs. One of the reasons why I wonder if monarchy would work very well in today's, milieu. I wonder. To show you how quickly things become problematic, and the breakdown, obviously, you know, when King James comes down from Scotland and comes into England and tries to handle the stuff inside the Church of England, there's not just disagreements inside the Church of England. Not everybody in England is part of the Church of England. There's a lot of Catholics left. And one of the instances that would illustrate some of the issues that came up is in 1605, which, if you're following your mindset, this is within the first 2 years of James's reign, is called the Gunpowder Plot. And I want to give you this little story because it really shows the tenor of some of the issues that were arising and the lengths that some people would go to try to establish their side of things. And don't hold to this because it's Catholic that I'm choosing that only because of that. There's plenty of error to go around on all sides. I just chose this one to show how hot tempered some of this got. The Gunpowder Plot of 1605, was a failed conspiracy that was put together by a group of English Catholics who were trying to assassinate King James I. He was a Protestant. I mean, here's the thing. The Protestants didn't really trust that he was a Protestant, but the Catholics feared that he was. And so it was enough to, in his first years, to have an assassination attempt, and quite an ornate assassination attempt at that. And not only to assassinate him, but to actually replace him with a Catholic monarch, which would necessitate a taking out not only of the king, but all of Parliament at the same time. And so let me explain how they did this. Those who were plotting this planned to blow up the House of Lords during the opening of Parliament in 1605. They did this by actually renting some storage underneath the parliamentary building, which was available for rent, strangely enough, and they had set up 36 barrels of gunpowder underneath the building that the House of Lords was to meet in, and to have King James I seated there during the Parliament's the opening, right? An anonymous letter alerted them to the conspiracy, and the plot was foiled by a man named Guy Fawkes, and the entire conspiracy's secrecy was, pun intended, was blown up. They never actually lit anything, and all of them were arrested the night of November 4th, and it led to a real deep prejudice against Catholics in England that led to a lot of difficulties in the years to come. In fact, this is kind of one of those places, again, like it was the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, at the beginning here of James's reign, you have a lot of Catholics persecuted and imprisoned and tried to deal with. This time, because there was actual threats, not only on the king's life, but to end Parliament as well, and to establish, as they stated, a Catholic monarch in his place. You would think that would draw James and Parliament together, right? Usually when somebody tries to murder you both, you get along a little bit. But the rest of James's rule, one of the things that keeps happening with Parliament is James has this intention to go do something. He doesn't have enough money to do it. And then, so he has to convene Parliament. Remember, that's how that works. He has to convene Parliament and bring them in, ask them for money. And then Parliament only gives it if he concedes to their spiritual demands. And here's the thing. Parliament is largely made up of Puritans at this time. And so James gets really frustrated with this whole system here because he keeps on having to bring in Parliament. Parliament has all these nitpicky things. I mean, he comes in and going, hey, we've got to defend this thing over here. You know, the 30 Years' War. He didn't call it that yet, obviously. The 30 Years' War is breaking out over in the mainland. We've got to address some of these issues over here. I need money to do this. And then the Puritans are coming back going, yeah. But what about crucifixes during the worship service? What about what we're allowed to do on the Sabbath, or what you're saying is okay on the Sabbath? And then James gets frustrated. They're not giving him finances, so he dissolves Parliament, and his financial situation gets worse. And so we return back to stage one. James needs money, and so he reconvenes Parliament. And this happens several times. And that cycle of this, I think, if you'll remember, is a little bit reminiscent of the issues of authority we were having in the 1400s. Who is really in charge here? Right? And some of you have been drawing parallels between, you know, the Pope and the Church. But I would also like to add on, not only is this like the Pope to the Church, it's also like the councils and the College of Cardinals to the Church. Parliament is a lot like the councils. And so the rise of conciliarism that we dealt with, you know, who's actually got more authority here? Is it the Pope or is it the councils? Here we have the same thing here. Almost practically speaking, if the king can't do something because Parliament won't give him money, who's actually in charge of what? And how did this really go down? Well, I'll tell you how it goes down. Each cycle, the relationships gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And right at the end of James's life, he is intending to marry off his son, Charles, to a princess that the Parliament does not like. And they start to condemn this idea. And in the middle of all of these things, James dies and Charles I comes to the throne. Well, Charles I has all the same struggles with Parliament and the Puritans that James I, his dad, had. But Charles I has none of the tact and none of the leadership abilities. He, in fact, goes through three parliaments in 4 years. And he brings them in, dissolves them, brings them in, dissolves them. And he has this way of making enemies that is legendary. When somebody tells him not to do something, he does it. when somebody forbids him to do something, he goes and does it. It doesn't matter what it is. He was intending to marry a French princess, a Catholic, and Parliament condemns it. And so, well, what do you know? Charles I is going to do it. And so what do the Puritans start calling her? She's Jezebel, right? She's the enemy. She's Catholic. She's foreign, bringing in, you know, idolatry. I mean, the parallels got bizarre. But Charles I is not having much of this. He brings Parliament in for several different financial aspects that he needed taken care of, but that doesn't really fly very well. They get dismissed and dissolved quickly. And then, you know, all of this goes down. Three parliaments. He dissolves the last one. He finds, fine, I'm going to rule by myself for 11 years. Not that he intended 11 years. I'm going to rule by myself. I don't need Parliament. And he really, the power of Parliament set with regards to the funding of what the king was going to do. And so his response to all of this is, as king, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. If I can procure funding outside of this, then so be it. I will do that. And I don't need Parliament. And so for 11 years, he rules without Parliament. He funds it through aristocratic sources. Now, there's a reason. It's not like he just made this up. There's a reason why this hasn't been done before, because it immediately alienates the lower classes of your culture. They see that they have no say in anything. And in fact, the appearance of it alone is that the rich people are rubbing elbows with our king, and we have no parliament, we have no say, we have no vote, we have no role. And so you have a king who's not going to listen to parliament and who's going to rub elbows with the richest people in the country and give them, you know, preferential treatment when it comes to trade and all sorts of things. And so the rich got richer, and, well, what happens to the poor? They're pressurized. They get frustrated. The people as a whole become disgruntled. It happens all the time when it comes to this kind of control, this kind of top-down insistence of things without any checks or balances in place. No one person can do that, right, without it disintegrating on some level or another. And so the people are looking around, and they're just going, you know, the enemy of my enemy is a Puritan. The group that has been calling out against the king began to gain support and popularity. And this is where I think a lot of people's misunderstandings about Puritanism as a grassroots movement. Puritanism was not a grassroots movement. Puritanism was inside Parliament. Puritanism was inside the houses of both the Tudor line and of the Stuart line. Puritanism was part of the Anglican Church from the earliest days, at least the tendencies towards this. It was not a grassroots thing. Not until the people and their goals aligned with the Puritans and their goals. And that doesn't even happen until the late reign of Charles I. And so the people are kind of looking around going, the enemy of my enemy is these Puritans. And while they've been nitpicky and all this, at least as the people are looking at the ostentatious and luxurious life of the aristocrats in England, they're looking around going, who else condemns this? Oh, wait, the Puritans have been condemning luxury and ostentation for years. Maybe we can join together on certain levels. And Puritanism became popular. And it was already railing against the luxury of the aristocracy. And, boy, this just makes everything worse. And Charles I being kind of one of these kings that, you know, if something's going bad, he just makes it worse. And one of the things that he does is make a man named William Laud the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, William Laud is spelled L-A-U-D. William Laud is made the Archbishop of Canterbury. He is a staunch opponent of Puritans and all dejectors. He basically looks at the role of the Archbishop as on par with the role of the king with regards to those who are in the church. There should be an absolute rule. There should be an absolute influence. And there shouldn't be a pulling back on any level whatsoever with regards to this kind of stuff. The controversy that he works over dissolving the Assembly of the Church in Scotland becomes the powder keg that just blows up into the English Civil War, at least the first part of it. And just a quick side note on that, there was disagreement in the Church of Scotland with regards to the authority of the Anglican Church. And Scotland, you know, being Scottish, refused to dissolve when they were told that they ought to dissolve with regards to their own assembly of the church in Scotland. Right, because here's the thing. The Reformation in Scotland had already gone on its own path before the Stuart line merged with England and they were trying to figure out all this kind of stuff. Scottish Reformation had already gone into and it had made its own Presbyterianism and its own structure. And so they were just working in their own life there. And William Laud comes in and goes, yeah, that's not going to be the case anymore. And any rejection of the authority of the archbishop or of the king with regards to spiritual matters, is not acceptable. And the assembly of the church in Scotland is to be dissolved. Well, Scotland, being made up of Scottish people, refused to dissolve. And instead, they abolished the Anglican authority from their lands and established the Church of Scotland entirely separate from the Church of England along a Presbyterian structure of authority rather than an Episcopalian structure. Episcopalian is more top-down pyramid-like. Presbyterian is much more lateral structure and authority. We'll get into Presbyterianism at some point. But here you start to have not only are the Puritans being joined by kind of the people of England, but now you have Scottish Calvinists and Presbyterians joining alongside English Puritans, all finding themselves on the same side, all hating the King of England, who is the king of them both. The year is 1640. Charles I has been on the throne for 15 years. He has gone through multiple parliaments, and the challenges back and forth to the church in Scotland and the developing uprisings in his own country. Charles I has no management expertise at all. And when it comes to addressing how to carry out these things, he doesn't really have a solution. There were escalating conflicts between Charles I and his people, between Charles I and Parliament. In 1640, if you want something for your timeline and outline, in 1640 to 1660, we have what is called the Long Parliament. Make a note here so I don't forget to mention something later. We have what's called the Long Parliament from 1640 to 1660. Now, the Long Parliament is so named due to its unusually long duration, which is kind of a fun thing to talk about. But in reality, it's not a normal parliamentary procedure that gets carried out here. The Long Parliament brought out this aspects of what had to be done. Parliament couldn't convene itself, but it had to call itself out. It had to gavel itself closed. Charles I had called together Parliament for an unrelated issue, something along the lines, but the Long Parliament here in 1640 led up to the issues of the Civil War that were going to break out. And what happened was that when the Parliament came together, at the behest of Charles I, and then he had them to disintegrate, to dissolve, and to leave, they refused to leave. And that continued. They were going to be a permanent check or balance on the king, whether he liked it or not, and they started passing important legislation that curtailed the king's power. And they would continue to function throughout the war. And even after all of these things that start coming through and struggling through in the English Civil War, there was a lot of things that were being carried out. And the Long Parliament itself was a result of and in tandem with the escalating conflicts of Charles I and Parliament. They played a significant role in the events leading up to the English Civil War. Once you start to have, it's kind of like imagine if a church council refused to listen to the Pope anymore and then just continued to meet and write. And you know, who's, again, it comes back to this issue, who's actually in charge here? Now, a lot of these guys that are in Parliament are Puritans. And it's kind of getting to a place where pretty much everyone hates the king. And, but they continued to pass important legislation that, that took away the king's power. And I'm not here to talk about the whole of Long Parliament, but in what ended up happening is in 1649, in the middle of all of this, the king, Charles I, is actually brought in before Parliament, tried, and put to death. He is beheaded. And so the killing of the king establishes a completely different expectation for what all of this is going to be going on. Now, this wasn't just a normal, everyday thing going on in Parliament. No, this is during the Civil War. Remember, the Civil War was going on from 1642 to 1651. It was in kind of three phases, but that's, you can look that up if you wish. But generally 1642 to 1651, in the middle of all of that and towards the end is actually when Charles I loses his head. And with that, then we have now, you want to get this picture. You have a Puritan controlled, a Puritan controlled Parliament that is making decisions on every aspect of life. And it, regardless of what the king wants to do. And not only are they making calls on these things, they're actually designing things, right? One of the most influential documents in all of English-speaking church history was written during this conflict, during the English Civil War. And it was written in England, in London, underneath the instruction of the Long Parliament, and that is the Westminster Confession. The Westminster Confession is one of the more impressive documents that has ever been written. If you are Presbyterian, you most likely learned the Westminster Catechism when you were coming to confirmation or something. The Westminster Confession is kind of probably a part of a lot of your background. But despite all of this, did you ever wonder why, since Presbyterianism came from Scotland, why Presbyterians use the Westminster Catechism and Confession, but the Church of England doesn't, when it was actually the Church of England that wrote it? This is why. Because it happened during the English Civil War. And during the English Civil War, like I just said, it was from 1642 to 1651. Well, let me give you the dates of the Westminster Assembly coming together to write this. It was 1643 to 1649. Right there in the middle of the Civil War, one of the things that the Long Parliament does during their controlling stage is to call in what were called the Westminster Divines. It's just theologians and churchmen respected that had Puritan theology, that had Reformed theology, and they were going to establish the final, if you will, chapter of the development of the English Reformation, and then they were going to stop, and that was going to be it. We're going to set up some kind of maybe Republican form of government. That was attempted, maybe some kind of democracy type thing. We don't have a king anymore. Parliament is in control. We're writing confessions, and so you're kind of looking at all this going, okay, I understand this. I get some of this. I get how that's going. You know, how is it that this all will shake out? Well, at the time, nobody has any idea. Hang on a second. Got to make another note or I'm going to forget something here. And so nobody has any idea how this is going to shake out in the long run, right? Because we have this benefit of hindsight and we're trying to figure out how all this is working out. But the reality is there's not just one or two or three different factions of everything. There's dozens. everyone's trying to establish something and some control on some level, right? So if you look back at some of these, as we call this kind of the confessional age of Protestantism, when it really kind of grows up, not only do you have the Westminster Confession being written from 1643 to 1649, right there during the English Civil War, but you also, if you're Baptist, like I am, the first London Baptist Confession of Faith is written in 1644, right down the street from Westminster. You know, it was a group of particular Baptists that came out and were trying to establish what it will be, to be, Protestant. And then they were trying to really express that they were different than Anabaptists. You know, we're not crazy radicals. Don't kill us or anything like that. But, you know, we're gonna try to address, all of these things best as we can, right? And then they go through with that. And that's the kind of, the father of the one that I would, ascribe to, the one that eventually becomes known as the Second London Baptist Confession. That's eventually in 1689. But regardless of such, all of this is going on at this time, right? And in the middle of all of this, we're trying to address so all of a sudden we have a country, we have a church, we have a parliament, no king. Now what? Now what do we do? How do we deal with this? And the Long Parliament eventually becomes trying to function through the war, trying to cover out everything, trying to figure out how to deal with the Civil War while it's going on. And in the middle of that, from 1653 to 1658. There was a man named Oliver Cromwell. Now, if you're like me, when I was in high school, I got Thomas Cranmer and Oliver Cromwell mixed up all the time. I think just because their last name for some reason looks the same to me. I think it's just that they both start with CR. But not to be mixed up with Thomas Cranmer, I say to myself, 20 years ago, but Oliver Cromwell, comes to, he's part of the English military. He's also a minor member of Parliament. But he takes on a very prominent role during the English Civil War and kind of rose up through, the Parliament, with regards to, people respecting him and carrying out. He was not with the Royalists. Obviously, the Royalists were those who supported the King and tried to defend the king in the middle of the Civil War. He was with the parliamentarians, those who, obviously, from their name, they defended the parliament's rights. After the execution of Charles I, Cromwell helped establish kind of the English Commonwealth, tried to make it a republic that replaced the monarchy, but the reality is that the entire structure of government was dependent on a monarchy. You can't just, I don't know if any of you are old enough that you're listening. I actually don't know the age groups of those who listen, but if you ever drove a stick shift, you know what I mean when I say you're trying to shift without using the clutch. That's kind of what happens here. You cannot just flip a switch and say, you know what theoretically works really better than monarchy? Maybe a Republican form of government or maybe a democratic form of government. You cannot do that to a culture. It will reject it. And this is one of those things is that he was in the middle of establishing this, and so is Parliament, trying to replace the monarchy with a form of democratic republicanish government. And that just doesn't work. And that kind of fails there before the first couple of years. And so he ended up taking over, as Lord Protector, not a king. Don't worry. Lord Protector from 1653 until 1658. And he was, for all intents and purposes, he was the head of state. But while Cromwell would hate to be called a king, supposedly, practically speaking, he's just a king, but by a different name, right? A king with a different view of himself with regards to those things. One of the things is that at least, you know, the English Civil War comes to an end in 1651. During that whole attempt at Republican form of government. And, but the nation just cannot work like that. immediately. You can't just make that happen. And so from 1653, for the next 5 years, Oliver Cromwell serves as Lord Protector. And I mean, for all intents and purposes, he's the king, right? And well, what happens in the long run here is that, the control of all of these things after, the office of Oliver Cromwell, shatters under his son within the first year. As it turns out, his son was not capable of holding on to this in any way that he was. Once he dies, everything quickly falls apart. Parliament starts losing control. And wouldn't you know it, Charles I's son comes to kingship. Charles II. Now, when Charles II comes to the throne, he's not going to treat very kindly those who put his father to death in a public way. And so not only do you have a reestablishment of the monarchy, but you have a rejection of things that were done during it, such things like the Westminster Catechism, the Confession, the First London Baptist Confession, and these types of things that were done in that interregnum are done away with. And so that's why even to this day, now Scotland's not going to pay attention to that. They're off now, kind of Presbyterianism is taking off on its own course at this point. But that is how the Westminster Confession becomes part of the Presbyterian world, but it's no longer a part of the Anglican world. Because when Charles II comes back, he just obliterates any of that as far as for a legitimate thing in anything in the Church of England. And so all of those things that were done, all of those leaps and bounds kind of get, they get imported to other countries and they are used. And so now here I am sitting in New York, right? And, you know, if someone asked me for a historic confession that I would hold to, it would be the 1689 Second London Baptist Confession. I don't live in London. I've never been a part of the Church of England. In fact, I've never even been to England, and yet I would hold to a confession that has been imported from England to here. And so when we look at all this, how does that really shake out? How does that break down? Well, it all kind of breaks down in the reality that when you have a church whose reformation is top down, every single time there's change from the top, it's going to filter down through the entire church. And so it takes so much longer for the English Reformation to understand what itself is. And I hope you've been able to appreciate some of that change. Now, to go back to why we're discussing this at all, why even discuss all of these things? These types of confessional or story bits become a whole bunch of the background of everything that happens in America going forward. If you grew up in church at all, or even tangentially related to it at all, you know names like John Bunyan. You know people like George Fox. You know names at least like this, the Quakers, the Baptists. All of this stuff comes out of the Church of England, and filters its way into America. As the Anglican assembly becomes quite allergic to things that it, doesn't really like. Puritanism becomes, a thing to be pushed against, a thing to be resisted in the Church of England eventually. And so what does it do? Well, like everything in the late 1600s, early 1700s, if it's in Europe and it's finding itself an unwelcome guest, it looks to the New World and it comes and establishes it here. And so if you're looking at, you know, early, you know, pre-United States colonial America, you're going to be looking at a lot of Puritans. You're going to be looking at a lot of Quakers. You're going to be looking at a lot of congregational churches and Baptist churches and later on Methodist churches. And you're going to be seeing all of these things. All of this stuff that's pouring out of Europe, all of these people with all these disparate beliefs are going to find themselves on the other side of the lake. And so not only do you have all of these things, the English speaking way, you're going to have pietists from Germany. You're going to have Amish, you're going to have Mennonites, you're going to have, you're going to have straight up, you know, Reformed. You're going to have my ancestors, the Huguenots from France, who are French Calvinists, who were chased out by the Catholics in France. You're going to have Catholics that were chased out by Protestant rulers, and they find their way to the New World. And so I say all this because one of the most influential countries that affects theology for the next 400 years happens to be England. And so when all of this is going down, the church is starting to realize that it's going to have to address its relationship to the state on some level somewhere. What do we do when a king is wrong? Are we allowed to chop his head off? Are we supposed to respect him? Are we supposed to listen to him no matter? What if he taxes us but doesn't listen to us? If you know anything about American history, you know that's going to be a big, big discussion. Taxation without representation, for instance. And that is a huge discussion inside the church. Should we submit to our rulers even if they're unjust, or should we only submit to them if they're just? Well, where's the line? Where does it start? Where does it stop? And how does it end? And the reality is we're still trying to figure out the answer to those questions. And that's why we work through church history, because those who came before us are still trying to address the issues that we are trying to address. And I don't know that we've come to a solid answer on any of it, honestly, because every time we get close to the state, we lose ourselves. And every time we get far from the state, it loses itself. What is that balance? What is the answer to all of that? I'm not going to argue that I have the answer. I don't. But I will say that it's much easier to see the possible answers when we understand what wrong answers there are in our past. And I think there's a whole lot of them to learn from, and a whole lot from our own past to learn from. With that, I am going to end us here a little bit early today, because I didn't want to overwhelm us with just the details of English history. You are welcome to go look all that up. There's a lot of good resources out there. But we will be back next week. We're going to be looking into Lutheran Pietism and the Pietistic movements that begin to formulate some of the more experiential sides of things before we get into things like the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution and some of these things. So with that, Lord's blessings to you all. I'm very much grateful to all the new people that we have joining us here. I'm not sure how you found us all of a sudden, but you're welcome. Welcome to take part at all and at all times. And for those of you who are on the podcast and you're wondering how to reach us live, I realize that I haven't explained that, so I'll explain it now. On Wednesday evenings each week, 6:30 p.m., we live stream this. That's Eastern time. We live stream this on YouTube. And the place to find that is youtube.com/@churchhistoryandtheology. And so if you want to follow us along and you want to take part in a live discussion, that's where we're going to be. It's nothing professional. It's just me sitting in my office and we're talking about all these things. You're just able to, post up comments and things like that. Not all of us can be as tech savvy as those of us who are posting up these comments, but, if you want to join in, that's the place to do it. That's the time to do it. You're always welcome. Lord's blessings to you all. God be with you.